Form the general strike committee tonight. That would be amazing. You'll volunteer.
Thanks, Kim. Okay, final speaker on the panel tonight, but hopefully you will take over the speaking, is Sharon Yandel. And Sharon, again, is somebody that many of you probably know. Sharon's been involved in the women and the labor movement for at least 30 years, mostly working with women in the public sector, low-wage women and unorganized women. And she's currently a member of the Vancouver and District Labor Council Women's Committee.
I'm not going to talk about the guaranteed annual income, or what Lee referred to as the guaranteed livable income, which is a better term, other than to say that this was once a very key demand of poor and working women, and I think it's time to bring it back and put it front and center again in terms of the issues and demands that we're raising. But tonight I'd like to talk about working on another front, and not instead of a guaranteed livable income, but as well as. And I'm going to be talking principally about poor and working women recognizing, or rather poor working women recognizing, that many women move back and forth between working and between work and lack of work. And I'd like to begin with an excerpt of, from a book that I'm working on at this point about my experiences working in the labor movement all these years. And this is from the introduction. I had spent some years in community organizing, largely with women on welfare and the working poor, and at one point was a member of a provincial government commission holding hearings into problems poor women faced. One day a group of three women presented the panel with an earnest and thoughtful presentation about their difficulties raising children in poverty. The problem, they said, is that they didn't have enough money. The solution, they added, was to have more. And I thought, of all the studies, commissions, hearings, panels, including the one that I was on that had studied the issue of poverty in Canada and, quote, the problem with the poor, unquote. And of course, the problem with the poor, as these three women pointed out, is that they don't have enough money. But that commission was not going to get them any more, and nor was the government, and nor was the community organizing that I was doing. What gets more money to working women, I concluded, is the same thing that gets more money to working men, and that is organizing into unions wherever possible. That was a central preconception with which I entered the world of trade unions. Several decades later, nothing has happened to change that view, and plenty has happened to reinforce it. So I'd like to talk a little bit about what happened after that, when I did get involved in organizing poor working women. And principally, I was organizing women who worked in private hospitals, which at that time were the central vehicles for caring for the aged and infirm. And these were dreadful, bloody, awful places. There were long hours, there were low, very low pay, there were workers eating soup for half the month, there were no benefits, there was no child care, they were on and off welfare, teetering on the edge, always between the two. There was many were running between two and three different jobs to try to earn a livable wage to support their families. There was no overtime. There was no observation of labor laws. There was one place that I was involved in organizing where the youngest worker was 13 and the oldest was 73. They lived on all of the circumstances that Jackie referred to. So you can imagine what a big surprise it was to me to find out that in hospital after hospital after hospital, the principal reason why these women were prepared to join the union at great risk to themselves because they could scarcely afford to lose their jobs was because of the conditions of patient care. That was what moved them to the union, not their own circumstances, as miserable as they were. And what I learned from that is that there can be a tremendous community of interest between workers and clients, between the providers of the services that people need and the people who need the services. Now, there were a couple of spin-offs, and I think important spin-offs of this kind of organizing, not simply in my own experience, but in the experiences of other people as well. There, as a result, in part, of this organization, there were big changes in the healthcare system. We were not only organizing and negotiating collective agreements and trying to bring up the standard of wages and working conditions for the people who worked in them, but we were blowing the whistle on the nature of patient care in these institutions. And we had to do that. Of course, we wanted to do it, but we had to do it because that was why they'd organized in the union in the first place. And that was a very principal reason why the publicly funded long-term care system came into being. That still exists, at least in some form today. That is a universal system that's funded through taxation. Now, there's not one poor or working or middle-class person in this province that has gone broke funding the universal long-term care system. It was affordable, and it still is affordable. Another thing that happened in this kind of organizing, and in a lot of union organizing, an organization, was to assist the universalization of benefits. The unions negotiated certain benefits, such as health care plans. And at the same time, people outside of the unions were arguing for the extension of those plans generally to everyone, not simply as a result of the negotiation of union contracts. This took place over a long period of time, and the drive and the push to have the socialization of benefits occurred largely, you know, in the community, certainly. But it was interesting to see the response of employers. Employers, the companies were not wildly keen on developing social programs, on the socialization of benefits, but they were extremely keen on the socialization of the costs. If these programs were, in fact, borne by the community at large through general taxation, they didn't have to pay for them for their own workers. So that mitigated to some extent their opposition. It shut them up on the question of the expansion of these social programs, because they could figure out an angle in which they could be they could benefit from it. And, you know, given a choice between paying for these benefits themselves and getting the general public to pay for it, well, I mean, they'll take the general public any time. Now, of course, they prefer to do neither. And far preferable is to end the ability of unions to negotiate these things and also kill off the social programs, which is exactly what they're doing now. And I raise those two aspects, those two spin-offs of union organization, only to illustrate that for every problem, there's more than one solution. There are ways of doing things that have been done and can be done again and can be done better. And the reason that they are not being done in that way now is because of the ascendancy of another ideology. But that's all it is. That's all it is. It's the ascendancy of a set of ideas that can be challenged and can be attacked. Now, the Campbell government, of course, is part of the worldwide corporate neoliberal agenda of globalization, and it's on the attack. And everywhere, women in particular, as has been said many times in the panel tonight, are bearing the brunt of the attack. The attack, there is a profound attack on the public sector, and that attack has two targets, and both of those targets are very largely women. First, as workers. I don't know if it's commonly known, but most women in unions are in the public sector. The great majority of unionized women are in the public sector. there are relatively very few women in the private sector. So when the attack is made on public sector jobs, it's an attack on those jobs that women hold in our society that attract a decent pay or a livable wage or something at least resembling that. And the point of the attack is to de-unionize these workers. It's to take away what they've got and to take away their ability to get it back. It's to create a level playing field. That level of the jobs that most women do. So that's the first line of attack. And it could not be clearer what is happening than in that attack than to look at the healthcare sector in this province. And for me, it's back to square one. I have a very personal connection with that, because these very same women, these very same kinds of women doing these jobs in hospitals of cleaning, of laundry, of cooking, of assisting in the kitchen, and so on, that these are exactly the women whose union jobs are being taken away from them and whose wages, whose livable wages, are being taken away from them. Their wages are being cut in half. Their benefits are being taken away from them. Their pension plans are taken away from them. And if they're not immediately teetering on the brink of poverty, which many of them are now, they sure as hell are going to be in another 10 or 15 or 20 years when they find that the pension plans they thought they were going to have, they're not going to have anymore. What's going to happen to these women? They're going to do exactly what they did 20 and 30 years ago. They're going to scramble between two and three jobs. They're going to be back eating soup for half the month. They're going to have no daycare. They're going to be exposed to all of the problems that were raised here tonight, of the vulnerability that they have on the domestic front, the vulnerability they have in their relationships. This is such a crime to see and particularly when you, for people who have had the privileges I have had of being able to see women change their lives through the process of unionization, which was not an easy process and created a lot of struggles and a lot of sacrifices for a lot of people, to see them driven back to the situation that they were in before is really quite heartbreaking. But the second attack on the public sector is an attack on women who need the services. Now, you just think about this. When they cut back the number of long-term care beds in this province, who's going to take care of those people? And, you know, one of the things that happened when the long-term care program came into effect, I think it was at the end of the late 70s, I think it was, that the bureaucrats did a little body count of how many long-term care eligible people there were taking up acute care beds and how many people there were on the waiting list. And they said there are X number of beds that are needed. So when the first long-term care facilities opened, when the program opened, suddenly they were flooded with these applications, because the one thing never dawned on them is the numbers of people who qualified for long-term care who were being taken care of in their home by legions of daughters and daughters-in-law. And when these women had the option, they took it. They chose that option. And for quite a few years, it took them years to be able to even move that initial backlog, because it never occurred to them that that was what was happening. It's the same thing for people who can't get into hospitals, who ought to be in hospitals but are at home and they're sick. Who is taking care of them when they're home and when they're sick? When they cut back daycare services and daycare spaces and they increase the cost of daycare, who's at home taking care of these kids? When they cut back benefits for single parents, who are the single parents? It's not only a class war, it's a gender war. It is majorly a gender war. Now, when I look at the situation, and as looking at it as we all do, and, you know, oh, God, I wish I could say, okay, here's the formula. Have you got your pens? Write it down and we'll get started. But I think we need to that there are three things, I think, that we need to focus on. First is that we need to relaunch the fight for the guaranteed livable income. By that, I don't just mean wages in money. I mean what's often called the social wage. I mean to fight back on the issues of universal education, on health care, on housing, on daycare, and to launch those fights not only in and from our own organizations, but to put demands on other organizations, on the labor movement, on the politicians. You know, a few of us were talking last night about how close we came in the 70s to actually having a guaranteed annual income. It was a very serious political discussion. Now, that didn't come about, of course, because enlightened people, you know, sat around the Rideau Canal and, you know, say, hey, that was a great idea. And it came because people were organizing and people were putting forward a coherent policy, a coherent program, and putting forward reasons for it, and because there was a great deal of unity around that. The second thing I think that we need to fight for and support the ability of women to organize into unions and to keep the unions they have. And it's perfectly understandable, particularly in the public sector, when so many workers have been put into policing roles and have been taken out of their advocacy roles, that it's the easiest thing in the world is to circle the wagons and turn the guns inward at each other. But these are the same people. When we're talking about working women and we're talking about poor women, we're talking about time frames and continuums. We're talking about subtle shifts in income. So many women are one paycheck away from welfare when there was welfare, and so many women are one man away from welfare. Somehow or the other, that identification has got to be recognized so that we know who the enemy is and who the enemy isn't. And thirdly, I think that we should do something that I don't know if we've really done a lot, and that is to try to identify and realize the true community of interest between workers who provide services and the people who use them. Because I believe in my heart of hearts that that community of interest is there. But it needs to be identified and explored and worked with. And finally, I think that we should go back to the beginning that I started with tonight and identify the problem. The problem with the poor is that they don't have enough money, and the solution is to have more, to have enough, and everything flows from that.
Okay, well, thanks to all the speakers, and now I really would like to open